You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Bald Move Pulp Feed. We got another great movie for you. It's 2010 Scott Pilgrim, and this is the ultra sexy 10-year anniversary version of the Scott Pilgrim podcast. On August 13th, 2010, the Scott Pilgrim versus the world was unleashed upon an unsuspecting the world. And you know what? The world didn't appreciate it. The world said, fuck you and your $80 million expensive pop culture reference laden hipster film. I don't want none of it, and it bombed out at the box office.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Edgar Wright had to go out into the streets and just start punching people to make money back for this movie.
Yeah, he had to convert corpses to coin. Yep. And barely made it back. Mm-hmm. And it's a damn shame because this thing, you know, was a graphic novel series that was, I don't think, finished at the time. So this might have, you know, really affected the fates of that poor Canadian gentleman. It was a video game, which I really liked, but it never got an update, nor did it ever make it onto like the modern machines of its day, because probably this movie bombed. And I own the Blu-ray, but it's a very bare bones copy. So you essentially got a director's commentary, some hastily thrown together blooper reels and trailers, and that's it. And I'm sure it would have gotten a lot more love had this been a big hit.
So there,
maybe
there
we can talk about supposed to be why it didn't.
Yeah, there was supposed to be a 4K re-release coming out now. And they were doing some stuff around it. Like, they did a live table read of the script recently,
yeah,
like
sure,
in the last week
that.
Or so. And they were going to re-release the movie, but then, you know, coronavirus, so...
This movie's cursed, but because this movie has become kind of a cult classic, it has found an audience in home video and other ways. But we'll talk about this. But yeah, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World 2010 is directed by Edgar Wright, which everyone knows Edgar Wright. He's famous for his Coronado trilogy of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End, as well as Baby Driver. Very cool. It's written by Michael Bacall and Edgar Wright. It's based on the graphic novel series Scott Pilgrim. By Brian Lee O'Malley, a Canadian artist, and it stars so many people who have since blown up. Michael Cera, George Michael from Arrested Development, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who thrilled us all in season 3 of Fargo, has done a lot of excellent work lately, honestly. Yeah. Ellen Wong, which I haven't seen her in anything much except for this, except for I guess she was in Glow, which you've seen several seasons of.
Yeah, she's one of the wrestlers in that.
Macaulay's brother, Kieran Culkin, the bedwetter from Home Alone 1 and 2.
Yeah, other than that, this is the first time I had seen him, which was kind of like, now that I know his thing, I'm like, oh, okay, this is just Kieran Culkin. But
he's really good.
He's great.
And then Chris Evans plays one of the Ramona Flowers' evil exes. Of course, you know, he went on to fame as Captain America. He was essentially famous for being the shitty fireman on the shitty Fantastic Four at this point in his career. Mm-hmm. Anna Kendrick plays Scott's sister. Allison Pill plays one of his bandmates. I think this is one of her first roles. Brandon Routh, Superman himself, with vegan superpowers in this movie. Jason Schwartzman, we're on a little bit of a Jason Schwartzman kick, plays the G-Man, Gideon Graves. Brie Larson, this is Superhero Central. We didn't even know it at the time, but it's Superhero Central. Captain Marvel herself plays Natalie Envy Adams. Aubrey Plaza? Aubrey Plaza, before anyone knew who the fuck Aubrey Plaza was, has got a memorable cameo. Nah, not cameo, guest starring role. And Mae Whitman, who a lot of people know from Parenthood, but I know as Katara from Avatar: The Last Airbender. Apparently
she does a shitload of voice work.
She does
in tons of stuff.
She does. This movie came out.
You're gonna just skip right over the other superhero in here, Thomas
Who?
Jane as the Punisher.
I have that later in the that was gonna Thomas Jane.
Yeah,
and the guy from Westworld,
Clifton G, what's his name? Charlie something Clifton Jr. I can't remember.
Yeah. God damn it. What's his
Collins? Clifton Collins Jr.? That sounds right.
Yeah, Lawrence from Westworld.
Yeah.
They play the vegan cops.
Right.
And everyone's having a great time in this movie. Mm-hmm. It looks like it was a lot of fun to shoot. And I really like this movie. This movie came out. I didn't think, like, I know it got a lot of buzz at, like, Comic-Con, and it was, like, one of those kind of, like, internet-famous movies. But at that point, like, Snakes on a Plane had come out and been shitty. So I didn't really have a lot of expectations, but I saw this opening night. I'm pretty sure you were there, and mm-hmm. Cecily was there, because Cecily and I were kind of dating on and off at this period of my life. Huh. And I was just blown away by just how breezy this film was, how much fun it was, and its visual audio design is just kind of off the charts.
The style
is a lot of fun to look at.
Yeah, it's relentlessly stylish.
It's, yes, and it's all kind of like aimed at, you know, Gen Xers, millennial sense of, you know, hipster sensibility, but
yeah,
more of like a gamer kind of grunge rock sensibility that I really got into. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like suburb Toronto, which I found mapped kind of neatly onto like my suburban Indiana kind of upbringing. So yeah. What did you think of this movie, Jim, 10 years later?
At the time I loved it. This was one of my favorite movies. I was in my late 20s when I saw this movie, and I felt a little bit like Scott Pilgrim trying to figure out life and love and all that stuff. Probably a little bit late because of my stunted cult background upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And so like a lot of the themes and just a lot of the confusion that he feels and the uncertainty I identified with. Looking back on it 10 years later, I'm like, oh, boy. Oh boy, this is a movie for young 20 20s people who are just trying to figure this shit out. And it's effective in that. Like, I think this is a really good movie still. There are very few parts of it that I look back on and just roll my eyes at. Mm-hmm. For the most part, the style holds up. And if you're in your, you know, late teens, early 20s, I think the messages, the themes, the troubles that Scott is dealing with still are relevant.
Yeah, it's funny. I watched this with my 13 going on 14 year old. And I'm like, hey, I'm watching this movie. Do you want to? I think that was the deal I struck him. I was like, well, if you want to, because he had a day outing he wanted to do. And I'm like, well, I got to work. So do you want to like watch this with me for my job? Because I think he's like, well, what is it? And I'm like, it's Scott Pilgrim. He remembers, like, this is one of the first video games he ever played on the PlayStation 3, which I definitely want to talk about. And he's like, okay. He's like, well, is it cool? Is it slow? And I'm like, nah. He's like, you know, give it 10 minutes. If you don't like it, you don't have to watch it. He ate it up. Although, the thing that he took about is how cringe, you know, like some of Scott, the situation Scott finds himself in are, like, very, you want to crawl into a hole or a crack in a wall, because he's just the social awkwardness and the social the stickiness that he gets himself into is pretty crazy. But it's also got a lot of fun. It's very funny. It's pretty action packed. I mean, they have fairly impressive Matrix style special effects laden fight scenes in these things. And it was fun for him because he, you know, recognized almost all the cameos. Like, you know, it was fun for him to see a young Captain America, young Captain Marvel, mm-hmm. Aubrey Plaza. He loves Community, Parks and Rec. So like seeing like barely out of her teens Aubrey Plaza, all that stuff was a lot of fun for him. And it was fun for me, too. So I feel like that and a lot of the messaging is pretty good. You know, like Scott is not living a very perfect life and he's making a lot of mistakes. But that's part of the message of the movie, is learning how to be true to yourself, learning how to be true to your friends.
Mm-hmm. And that by being true to yourself and being honest with people, you can actually be better to them, right? Like, it seems like there's this dichotomy between, oh, I got to lie to this person to make them feel good. But if you do that, you actually make them feel bad in the long run. So
Right. Yeah. And they express it in terms of, like, leveling up. There's this video game aesthetic where, like, every time Scott has a self-realization, he gains a new weapon or an extra life or, like, his stats visibly increase on the screen. And all that stuff is, I think, pretty neat. There's been a lot. I read many, many essays about the importance of this film in what they call the transmedia movement, which is using various forms of mass media to tell stories. Sometimes it can be like, a movie that also has a video game where plot is important that then leads to a sequel that's based on a video game. It's just like you're actually using multimedia to tell a story. Sometimes it can be like in this case. I guess this is like it checks off all the boxes. It itself is multimedia transmedia because it uses video game aesthetics and music aesthetics to tell a conventional story, but also this story took place in a graphic novel and in a video game of the same title, and they all kind of like complement each other and feed into each other's sensibilities. Like Scott Pilgrim defeats someone in a video game, it turns into cash that you can use to upgrade his weapons and abilities, and in the movie people burst into coins and points because that's what they do in the video game. I really like it. What do you want to? Should we talk about the premise of the film and then get into some spoilers?
Let's talk about the premise and then maybe how it was received.
Okay. So the premise of this film is Scott Pilgrim. He is a Canadian youth. He's 22 years old. He had a bad breakup last year with a girl who went on to become an international famous rock musician, which has destroyed his ego. He has been reduced to dating a 17-year-old high school student that all of his friends rag on him for. He's in a band that's kind of floundering. He's between jobs. And in the midst of this, in skates this fantastic woman, Ramona Flowers, who is a hyperspace-capable Amazon delivery girl. American, which is, you know, apparently extra juice for a Canadian, the exotic American from the South. And he sets his sights on wanting to date her. And to do so, he has to level up as a young man and figure out what's worth fighting for. And crucially, she has 7 evil ex lovers that have banded together into a league to control her destiny dating life. And he has to defeat all 7 to win her hand in dating. Because they don't do marriage. They're early 20s grunge people. They're not going to get married. Come on.
No.
Come on. And that's the movie.
Unfortunately, the movie was a big flop. It cost about 80 plus million dollars to make, and it only made about 48 of that back. It's literally the only movie that Edgar Wright has ever made that didn't make money, and didn't make a lot of money, honestly. Like, so many of his movies did, like, a $6 million budget, and he made $60 million or something. Or the latest World's End, he, you know, had a budget in the tens of millions and made over 200 and something million. So, like, this is kind of the exception in his career. That was Baby Driver. I don't know why this movie flopped so hard. I don't know if it was the niche of this being a comic that people just weren't familiar with, and that maybe Edgar Wright wasn't quite as big then as he is now, so he couldn't sell it on his name alone.
Yeah, but this was so huge on the... I mean, this is... I remember when this bombed, the conventional wisdom was starting to come around to, like, well, you can't market things on the internet. If you're big on the internet, it just doesn't trans... Because, like, look at Snakes on a Plane, look at Scott Pilgrim. Like, yeah, you can fill an auditorium at Comic-Con with 10,000 screaming people, and that's exactly how many tickets you'll sell. Because the other thing is, like, Universal got behind this. They spent a lot of money marketing it. It was, I mean, that's how I heard about it, because I wasn't on the Comic-Con circuit back then. You know, they developed a video game based on it. It was already a successful graphic novel that had done well in the comic book stores. I don't know. I really don't know why Because if you were excited about this based on like your internet participation, this movie is exactly what it said it was going to be and exactly what it said it was going to do and succeeded. It was commercially or critically a success. Like it, I think right now it has like 83% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. And I believe that score was even higher back in the day. I am puzzled. I tried to read a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of people saying, well, maybe we didn't market too well. I guess the international marketing is marketed as like a kid's film because of like the video game aesthetic and all that, like, and the, a lot of animation kind of reads like childish. But
it's like that era's Pixels or something like.
Yeah.
Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah. But like, this is a, is, I guess this is YA at its core.
Yeah, I would say.
And maybe that had just hadn't blown up yet because something like this made about teenage, like late teens and early 20 something, that's your bread and butter.
Yeah.
I can't figure out why this wasn't a big hit. I'm glad it's become a cult hit since. But I really don't. All the reasoning for why it failed as far as its ad campaigns and stuff, as someone who went through it contemporarily, I still don't know. I don't know why it failed so hard, but it did.
I do feel like when this movie was released, pop culture as like on the internet was still building. And I think it's still building today. Sure. You know, it isn't what it was, or it isn't. It wasn't then what it is now. Like you didn't have hits on the level of like Avengers that would be out there making $1.5 billion or whatever, based on the popularity and the buzz on the internet, because the mainstream I think was still, you know, watching pretty standard movies, non-niche movies. Even the younger people were still very much like just not like that bought into like pop culture is exploding on the internet. I mean, you look at that, that's around the time the Bald Move started. And television criticism on the internet was almost non-existent in podcast form. It was like us and a handful of other outlets doing that. And so I just don't think like the traction was there for a purely internet-based like type of thing.
The virality just wasn't for something like this.
Yeah, like that's the era when on YouTube, virality still meant like you're doing a stupid thing with a dumb hat and a cat or something, and your mom and your cousin are watching it, and they've never heard of Scott Pilgrim. Nowadays, it's like, you know, the virality means a totally different thing. And then there's that manufactured virality to stuff as well.
Sure.
But yeah, so I think the internet was just not ready to support something like this. And I don't know that Scott Pilgrim was like the most popular geek property either. Like it was big in like comic circles and alternative comics and stuff. And I had heard of it in passing, but I was not a fan of Scott Pilgrim, the comic. I just thought this movie looked really cool. And I knew that, hey, this is the guy that did Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah. I do think that like, 10 years later, how do we feel about Michael Cera? Because I do feel like he's very good at the socially awkward parts of Scott Pilgrim. Because I've read, I haven't read all the graphic novels, but I read like the first four. And you know, Scott's like just essentially a normal dude, but he's like a really good fighter for whatever reason. And he's just kind of like a regular guy. And I feel like Michael Cera is several notches below what I would call a regular guy. And he does really good at the socially awkward stuff, but he doesn't do very good at like the intrinsic charm that Scott Pilgrim's supposed to have. You know, he's supposed to be a lady killer, like accidentally. He's just like, you know, very good looking, talented, and guys got this natural kind of confidence and charisma about him that might be temporarily tarnished because of, you know, having his heart stomped out by envy. But Michael Cera is utterly unconvincing in all of the stunt work. You know, he doesn't look like, and I'm not saying he needed to be like a big muscle bound dude, but like he looks like he would hurt himself doing those stunts, and that's the thing that kind of jumped out at me, is just that he's just very and I guess it helps that in most of the fights where he's outmatched, like, I don't buy that he can beat Superman or Captain America.
Yeah.
He defeats him through trickery and guile. But yeah, I don't know. There's a couple times where he has to have a little bit of swagger to him, and I felt like those parts fell flat. Like, the movie works best when it's kicking him, and when he is, like, a champion, then it's kind of like, womp, womp, but yeah. I don't know that that's a fatal error.
No, I still... So I'm not familiar with, like, the characteristics of Scott Pilgrim. Like I said, I'm not a big fan of the mm-hmm. comic. And so to me, I wasn't noticing those problems that probably fans of the comics might have had with this movie. But I thought he was good. I like Michael Cera for what he is, and I don't know that I need him to be much more than that.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out why, like, people saw these trailers and just like, nah, fuck this movie.
Yeah.
Because I think the rest of the cast, like Mary Elizabeth Winstead, is got all those kind of like boxes checked for this like alt girl fantasy. Right. She's extremely attractive. She's extremely charismatic. She does have this like, I don't give a shit what you think about me kind of thing. And like also just more of a, she's like a Scott Pilgrim after the film. Like the sequel to this, Ramona Flowers versus the World probably looks a lot like, you know, Scott, where she's just kind of blundering through people's lives and breaking people's hearts and not being really careful and not thinking about what she's doing as far as like building blocks of her life. Mm-hmm. But she's entering this movie much more self-assured and knowing what she wants, or at least knowing what she doesn't want, and moving confidently to get it. And she's just completely rock solid in that role. She's excellent. And, you know, all of Scott's, like, the people that orbit him are just such amazing characters. Like, Kieran Culkin, as his gay roommate, is, I think he's might be the best part of this film.
He might be. I mean, he's kind of the best part of anything he's in. But I would say, like, okay, if you're going to pick at Michael Cera for being just, for only being able to portray this nerdy guy and not other aspects, well, you got to pick at Kieran Culkin, because that... he's not acting in this movie, right? Like, they're giving him lines and he's just saying them. Like, he could have shown up on set that day, just read them as Kieran Culkin and been done, gone home, right? Everything I've seen him in, he's been exactly this character.
But just the physical acting, like, I love the scene where he comes in, he's like, guess who's drunk? And then he flips his keys, hits him in the back of the head, and just collapses into the bed.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And the running gag of him, like, spilling Scott's beans the second he gets them, like, you know,
even when he's
like,
unconscious. How did you do?
Yeah, you see him unconscious, but he's got the phone in his hand, and, like, I face down in the mattress. I just love that shit. I love the recurring motif of Scott waking up with a nightmare, and then Kieran Culkin waking up and asking what's wrong, and then, like, his succession of boyfriends sitting up and be like, what do we do?
Against Kieran. I love Kieran. I love Jeff Goldblum. I love a lot of character actors who are not even character actors, who are hardly even actors. They're just people who are extremely charismatic and a joy to watch. There's nothing wrong with that.
I thought Anna Kendrick was really good as a sister. I thought Aubrey Plaza was really good as Julie Powers. Mm-hmm. Like that little thing, you know, because this is a PG-13, does it have a single fuck in it? The device they have of her, like, her mouth pixelating and the line noise going over all of her, like, filthy mouth, I love. And Aubrey Plaza is the perfect person to have in that role. And, you know, I haven't seen a lot that I like Brie Larson in, to be honest. And I don't like Captain Marvel. Not for because I hate women, just because I think Captain Marvel is not a great addition to the Marvel pantheon at this stage of the Marvel. And then she's barely anyway. She's amazing in this film. Like what she's doing as this kind of like sex pot pop star, like this with this breathy appeal, and how her and like Brandon Routh have got those synchronized like withering stares that they give people. They snap and the camera follows them. And it all works together, like the editing, the camera work.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like practical camera work that they do where actors are like popping up and into a snap focus as the camera pans to some other reaction. It's it's just really this frantic style that adds and props up the humor that's on display.
Oh yeah, and it's Edgar Wright through and through. Like, you can feel the momentum yes. of Edgar Wright's directing. Edgar Wright's cinematography. I don't know who the cinematographer on this is, but they did a fantastic job. And I don't understand how you can even do this. You have to have such a clear vision of what you want to get these shots. Especially, I'm thinking of the parts where he's jumping around between scenes. Like, I don't mm-hmm. know if he's losing time because he's thinking about Ramona Flowers or what, but like,
right.
he'll be 1 minute in his, you know, secret lair with Kieran Culkin, and he'll be mid-sentence talking to him, and then he jumps to like a club, or he jumps to, you know, the coffee shop or the record store. Yeah, it's
yeah.
You have to know exactly what you want out of that entire series of shots before you even sit, like, put a person on set, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I looked at, like, there's one article I read that had some storyboarding where it looked just like shots right out of the graphic novel. And I'm like, you got this shot out of this? Because it's not yeah. just all the camera work you're doing and the editing that you know is going to have to take place, but all the post-processing. Because right. damn near every frame on here has some kind of rendering, some kind of like extra punch to it. Like, even when, like one of my favorite scenes is like the first time the movie gets really this surrealist, when like they're selling the idea that Knives Chow is being exposed to cool music for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And like the living room stretches out, and like you can see like these like waves of like Technicolor power start to emanate from the band as they start playing. It's almost like this old like Max Fleischmann Superman cartoon effects where like there's radio waves and stuff radiating out. It's just really cool, and you got to get the shot without any of that happening and then know it's going to be there.
And then Edgar Wright is
a genius.
Yeah, he's amazing at this. And a lot of the tricks that I see in this movie, I know that he uses in his other films, like the Cornetto trilogy specifically. But he's using them in slightly different ways here. I'm thinking of like scenes in the bathroom where Scott Pilgrim is like using the bathroom and washing his hands, right? You got the pee bar in the back that drains mm-hmm. just almost instantly. He walks over uh-huh. the sink, turns on and off the water, gets his hands, just
kind of waves his hands.
Waves his hands on the towels and walks out. And it's like a maximum 5 second shot. Uh-huh. And I remember like similar scenes from like Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz or something where people are in the bathrooms getting ready. And it's a lot of like quick cuts between these things happening. So he's doing like similar things and has a similar momentum, but he's using different editing styles and tricks to get it. They're roughly the same feel. And I think that's good, right? Because he could fall into the trap of just doing the same thing over and over. But I think Edgar Wright is better than that.
Yeah, and I talked some shit about Michael Cera, but I'm going to defend him because what he's really good at is his comic timing for all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like him being able to get all that bathroom stuff done. Him able to sell like how smooth he is with the 17-year-old and how the exact same shtick just gets him destroyed when he tries to run that game on Ramona Flowers.
Yeah.
You know, him sliding into the frame and starting up with like, do you know why Pac-Man's called Paku Paku? And he's really, really good at that. And, you know, since that's 75% of what Scott Pilgrim has to do in this movie, it really, really works. Also, you know, I think one of the worst things about media that's about something that's not, like, you know, we talked about this, Mad Men may be an exception because I thought most of their fake ad campaigns are pretty good. But yeah. A lot of times when you've got a movie about a band, the music sucks because these are filmmakers. They're not, you know, maybe they play guitar on the side or whatever. But Michael Cera, I guess, is a really talented bassist. And the yeah. other people in, like, Alison Pill on drums, they all went to band camp and learned how to play convincingly on screen. And crucially, they hired actual professional musicians to come up with the music for the bands are playing. And what I thought was a really good touch that shows a really good attention to detail is, like, they got Beck to write all the music for Scott Pilgrim's bands, the Sex Bobombs, but they got a different band. Like, they had the producer of Radiohead do the music for the Japanese twins.
Okay.
And they had another indie band produce the music for Crash at the Demon Head. So, like, not only did you get professional musicians of the style that these bands would to write actual songs that could plausibly chart, But you hired several different ones because, like what Edgar Wright said in interviews, like, you know, a lot of times when you do this, you hire one composer and you can kind of tell. Yeah. It's like if you had Beck Wright for five different bands, he would do a good job, but they'd all sound like Beck projects, right?
Sure, sure.
By mixing it up, you actually felt like, oh, these are all these different musical styles that are of the era, that are contemporaneous, but they don't feel samey, and they also are legitimate jams. Like, a lot of the songs on here that are the fake songs are toe tappers, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I like most of the Sex Bomb music. I feel like they should have given Beck a shot at writing the whole thing, because if there's any artist I can think of that's like cross genre like that, it's probably Beck. He's crazy.
Yeah, you compare like his Loser day to like Odelay and some of the later stuff, like he definitely goes to lots of different genres for sure.
Yeah, at least give him a shot. You're right, that was a smart decision to get different feels for each of these bands, and you know, crucially hiring people who write that type of music too. It's not just like, oh, we got different people to do these so they sound different, but like, you don't want to bring John Williams in to try and write a Sex Bomb song, right?
No.
Like
no,
a composer or something like that. You want a dude who's making grunge music.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next Pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Yeah. The other thing I thought was a really smart instinct is to capture, because there's a lot of fight scenes. That was one of the common criticisms of the movie, is that like, if you're not into these kind of hyper surrealistic fight scenes, you probably got bored the third one in and you still got four more.
Fair.
But he said that he wanted this to feel like an old time musical, like that these were hyper realism, but the universe itself did not acknowledge it. Like Gene Kelly in like Singing in the Rain, you know, he does these amazing dance numbers and no one runs on camera at the end of it and's like, oh my God, that was fucking amazing. I can't believe we got to see something that cool. Like these giant, you know, earth shattering fights break out at clubs and destroy buildings and everyone's just drinking their beer and eating their pizza.
Yeah.
Because that's not literally what's happening. It's establishing a mood and a conflict and an emotion that is bigger than what can be, than real life can contain. But you're also supposed to understand that it's all, you know, at the end, Gene Kelly's just dancing because he's in love with a girl and he doesn't care that he's getting rained on.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you saw someone, you know, I thought that was a really nice touch too, the fact that like all these take place in their own little reality, but they're also in our reality, and the way the background, like for example, you know, Chris Evans does this crazy skate stunt where he wipes out at 400 kilometers at the end of this epic rail grind. At the end of it, the director is just like, cut, you know, next, there's no like acknowledgement, like, oh my God, the star of our movie is just exploded into coins.
Yeah.
I like that. And it's also very, the juxtaposition of that is extremely funny.
Mm-hmm.
But you also get like ridiculously cool stuff. Like when I think one of the standout fights is when Ramona Flowers steps in to fight her ex-girlfriend. And they introduced the, like, you know, Ramona versus Mae Whitman, whatever her name is. And she pulls out that ridiculous hammer out of her purse.
Yeah.
And then the ninja girl's got this like whip belt. It's just really fucking visually cool.
Mm-hmm. And those all became weapons in the video game too, which I appreciated.
And the wire work is done really, really well. I own the Blu-ray of this, and I listened to the commentary, which is not super interesting. And I watched some of the like behind the scenes stuff. The it's pretty bare bones, but like in the bloopers, they, you know, you could see Jason Schwartzman in his like full wire foo rig. I mean, you know, Jason Schwartzman and Michael Cera, not known for their stunt work, but
sure,
they are pretty convincing when they're doing it. There's like all this digital processing. Like, I don't know how they did the digital sword effects on Jason Schwartzman, you know, like purely digital katana, but it looks fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it really sells that fight reality.
And their ability to blend the actor with what must be a stunt person, a stunt double, is impeccable. Like it's almost completely invisible. I could tell, you know, when there was a stunt person in there, but only really because of how well the moves were performed. And I was like, well, there's mm-hmm. no way Michael Cera just threw a roundhouse kick that looks like that. But you know, when he spins back around, he's Michael Cera. He's not, there's not even a moment where I can see like, oh, that's the frame where they kicked back into Michael Cera's performance. It's really well done.
And I just like some of the other, like, very specific to this kind of slacker hipster culture, like all the various characters and the way they're dressed. I love like when Scott is infiltrating G-Man's hideout, the passwords are all like, oh, whatever, you know, just like groans and dismissals.
Uh-huh.
I love Vegan Edge, Brandon Routh, that, you know, when he's like in full vegan power mode and like he looks like he's gone Super Saiyan. And then when the vegan cops show up, first of all, Thomas Jane,
yeah,
really fucking funny. And they're like depowering him, and they list his list of crimes, and it's like he ate gelato, he ate a half and half, and then he had just chicken parm.
One of my favorite lines in the whole thing is when he's like, "Gelato isn't vegan." He's like, "It's milk and eggs, bitch."
Yeah, Jane, milk and eggs. He's like, "Gelato's not vegan." Then he's like, "A chicken parm, like chicken's not vegan." Yeah, and yeah. he gets depowered and so destroyed.
That's my least favorite part of this movie, is the vegan powers thing. Up until Thomas, the vegan police show up.
Why don't you like it?
It's just real dumb. It's just real dumb. I don't even know where they're getting this idea of like vegan powers from. Is this like a meme that I don't know about or something?
I think it's that. You know, vegans are a lot more accepted nowadays, but the early adopters of veganism, it's kind of like CrossFit. Like, they couldn't stop talking about
it. Yeah, they're evangelists.
And how much better, you know, like, they're super healthy, and oh my God, my skin's never been better, and I'm dropping all this weight, and I'm getting better sleep, and my poops are more consistent. And it's like kind of like this vegan propaganda turned up to 11, to where you actually develop superpowers and precognition, and if you maintain this vegan edge. And it's just kind of like, I feel like it's aged kind of poorly, because you know, like, I don't think vegans are as seen as nearly as insufferable now that more people are doing it, and it's not as special,
becoming
as it used
more
to be.
Accepted. But it's perfect casting there, like casting Superman. Because don't forget, you know, Brandon Routh was Superman back in those days. It's a really funny bit of casting, but I thought it, man, that's one of the dumber parts of the movie. But I'm looking at this through the lens of like, look, I've seen so many bad early 20s, like college coming of age kind of stories. I've seen so many done way worse than this. Like, this is actually a really stylish, slick, funny, not cringy version of that in almost every scene. So I don't want to take too much away from this movie by saying, oh, it's got this dumb part in it. Yeah, every movie does.
And like I said, as someone who sat down and watched with my 13-year-old, like, I didn't have to provide, like, a lot of coming age films, especially ones that are shot in the 80s and 90s. Like, you got to do a lot of like, you know, this is actually not super cool, what's happening.
Right.
I mean, there's definitely, like, Scott does a lot of stuff that's, like, not cool. You know, because, like I said, 22-year-old dating a 17-year-old high school is sketchy. But the movie articulates why it's sketchy, and it's not, doesn't show that, like, Scott's cool for doing this. It shows that, actually, yeah. it's from a place of patheticness, that he is wanting a girl who's easy to impress, who doesn't have any, like, formative experiences, mm-hmm. So that he can kind of just, like, coast through the relationship. Yeah. And like the perils of trying to like lie, you know, like as you said in the beginning, like in ostensibly to protect people's feelings and all. But also I felt like it also showed that like really what Scott's doing is just trying to be easy on himself. It's not yeah. that he necessarily cares that he doesn't want to hurt Knives, although that's definitely, but it's more of like, oh God, it's hard and uncomfortable. And all of his friends call him out for his bullshit. And, you know, as he levels up and becomes more of a complete person, he stops doing that stuff. And in fact, you know, and I wish there was a little bit of time on the Nega Scott, because it's a funny joke that you think that, you know, you have to do this mirror match.
Yeah.
And at the end, he just kind of like befriends his inner shadow and they have a lot of things in common. Like, that's pretty funny. But I actually think that could have been a very interesting, like, 3 or 5 minute scene, too. Like, him coming to grips with his insecurities and his self-doubts and his negative, his inner critic, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, for a coming-age film of where showing people realistically making mistakes and, you know, kind of being callous with other people's feelings, it didn't have me like, oh fuck, having to provide a whole bunch of context so my teenager doesn't get the wrong idea, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, all the insecurity that Scott is showing, you know, he maybe needs a win, he maybe needs some confidence boosting, and that's probably why he goes to, you know, the easy victories mm-hmm. with dating a 17-year-old. But also, like, he's got some serious issues with like other people's baggage that he needs to deal with. Like Ramona's seven sure. Evil exes is, you know, obviously the prime example of that, but it's like, as you, I feel like that's a thing, you know, when you're younger, it's very much like, oh, what is their past? What is their love like sure. life like before this? And oh, yeah. how I'm going to have to deal with their exes and all the baggage that comes
with
that.
She's got some battle scars, dude. You know,
right. you know, as you get older, you just start to understand, look, everybody's got this. Everybody sure. lives a life before you
Me
met
included.
Them. Right, mm-hmm. you included. And I think, you know, Scott starts to understand that a little bit when they're dealing with his ex, you know. And I think, like, that's a pretty good message for people who are in this situation. Just understand that, like, that's, yeah, people have baggage. And you will need to deal with that, but you got to do it in healthy ways. You can't be so over concerned with like living up to some perceived expectation that you think they have, something they want different from their past. You just need to be you and things will sort themselves out.
Yeah. Oh man. Speaking of exes, I love the visual motifs of like those exes show up all over the place. And there's one scene where there was 6 exes. And I'm like, well, that's wild. They didn't have the 7th ex. And then Scott rips off the X-Men patch from his shoulder and throws it on the ground. And there's the 7th ex.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do a lot of stuff like that. Like one of the funniest bloopers is Michael Cera trying to land that FedEx package into the trash can.
Uh-huh.
It took him like 37 takes, dude, to get it. And it's just like, yeah, because, you know, it's kind of tricky. You're throwing it over your head and you can't.
I mean, there are easier ways, right? Just throw it out of frame and then have somebody drop a package.
That's where I'm like, man, like, how many more takes does this have to get before they just do that? You know what? Yeah. Throw it out of frame. We'll have someone with a ladder drop it in and then we'll just fuck it and fix it in post because.
Yeah. Movie magic.
Yeah. Yeah. That scene. But there was like this, like, whole team of guys like retrieving the package, throwing it off the frame, hand it to a guy who can hand it so they can just keep like bucket brigading, throwing these packages one after another.
Wow. It's like bailing a sinking ship or putting out a fire or something, right?
What else do we want to talk about movie wise? Because I kind of want to spend a couple minutes talking about the video game, which is honestly, unironically, one of my favorite like arcade style beat 'em ups of all time.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
So this, first of all, this is an amazing kind of like 8-bit, 16-bit action game. It's only for the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3. It was never ported to any other platform, which I was surprised. I actually thought, like, oh, there's probably a Steam port or something. I kind of had some nostalgia to want. I wanted to play through it again. But it's real fun, and it's got music by the fantastic 8-bit artist Anna Managuchi, mm-hmm. which you've never heard of. They used to provide us the theme music for the, what'd you call it?
Blue Yonder podcast.
Our very first podcast. Like the opening was their Helix Nebula. They did all the music for Scott Pilgrim, and it's an amazing music. The 8-bit art is great. It's a lot. This is a beat 'em up in the same vein as like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Marvel's The Avengers, Double Dragon, Streets of Rage, Final Fight. Like you're just going through all these side scrolling and vertically scrolling levels. You've got power attacks and light attacks. You can pick up weapons. You can throw people. You can, you know, perform special attacks on them. And the other thing is when you beat the piss out of people, they explode into Canadian currency. Mm-hmm. Like you've got the loonies and the stags and the beaver coins, and you get all this pocket change, and you can turn them in at various shops to upgrade your, like each character's got like, I think, strength, like heart, will, which directly boost your attack, your defense, and like your special attacks. And you can, I think, invest in books that gives you different attack techniques, and you can buy different weapons and whatnot. And it's just a really fun game. Like every single stage, like the overworld map is like a map of the suburb of Toronto, where it's got like, you know, the bus stops and every place you go. You start off on Scott Street. You've got like it uses the there's like secret levels, so you can unlock these hyperspace doors. If you know where to find them, they'll take you through these bonus stages. And it's just a really fun it's just a really fun and nostalgic game to play. And it's one of the very first games that my son and I beat together. Like it's like Little Big Planet and Scott Pilgrim versus the World and Castle Crashers. I'm not sure which of those games we beat and in what order, but that was it. And Mega Man 2 on emulator. But it's if you got a PlayStation 3 or an Xbox 360 kicking around, it's worth the $5 to get this game and play through it. In fact, I played through it because I kind of got obsessed with upgrading all the characters. And you can play as Scott, Ramona, Kim, was it Styles? Stills? He's the talent. I think you can unlock Knives Chow, yes. too. Like, if you defeat her, like, he's an old man riding the bus, and if you defeat him in a certain way, you can unlock her as a playable character. And you can also like do tag team moves, like a super special attack where Scott can like call knives in with a barrage of knives on the ground, and you know Scott can call in Ramona Flowers and she kisses him and does some kind of explosion. It's just really fun. It's a solid video game, and it's a damn shame this movie didn't make more money, because I think if it made its money back, they probably would have ported it to the PlayStation 4.
Yeah,
and
probably.
The Xbone, and I would be playing.
Or at least PC.
I'd have played it this week.
Like, convert it to PC so that I could play it on in any era. Because, like, being stuck on an old console really sucks.
Especially, I think the PlayStation 3 is also kind of infamously hard to emulate, right? Like, it was like that crazy parallel RISC architecture that... Yeah, that take like, you know, even though we have way more powerful machines, it's just very hard to emulate that. So maybe it's possible today, but I've never been able to get a good PlayStation 3 emulator.
My only complaint about that game,
check that out,
is that it kicked my ass. The game is hard.
It is very hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the like you, I think you, because also that's the other thing is like you had to beat it in one go. You could use like the hyperspace tunnels to bypass things, kind of like in Mario, but you had to, like, if you got to the final stage, you had to get there. Once you ran out of lives, you had to start all, you could save, but like once you ran out of lives, that was it. So it's kind of, I think, designed to kick your ass, and you have to level up, and you know, if you're struggling, go through some of the areas multiple times. But the variety of enemies, like when you're fighting the Chris Evans guy, the stunt, you have to fight a stuntman, and there's also dudes that are wearing green screen mocap suits that blend into the background until they come like screaming at you, and like director's assistants come at you with like swinging lights and shit. Like, they're like, when you fight Negascot, it's like set in a graveyard, and there's like zombie versions of the characters popping out of the ground. You got ninjas and samurais when you're trying to defeat the ninja girl. And like, I think the Japanese twins eventually form a Voltron robot that you have to go through the rooftop to like defeat, like their individual hands and then their chest platforms and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
It's super fun. It's really fucking elaborate. They spent a lot of money and time on that game, and it's criminally underappreciated.
Yeah, we forgot to mention,
like, Scott Pilgrim the film.
Right. We forgot to mention how integrated, you know, that the idea of a game is into Scott Pilgrim, because it's not just, you know, the coins pop out of people, or there's like round one or whatever. Which, did you know that's Bill Hader doing those voices? He's credited as the voice in this movie.
I did not. That's cool.
Yeah, that's cool. But the end of this movie, the battle with Gideon, he uses a game mechanic to defeat him, right? That one up that he grabs.
Mm-hmm.
He dies, and then he comes back with his one up, his extra life. And yeah, the movie is made, is absolutely made for a time when gaming is getting big. You know, it's always, I've always been a gamer, so I feel like gaming has always been a big thing, but it certainly hasn't. It was probably big before 2010 when this movie was made.
Sure. But it's gotten even bigger now.
But now, like, yeah, now it's just bleeding over into movies and novels and music and everything.
I remember some time ago, I think it was maybe about 10 years ago, that like video games make more money than Hollywood.
Yeah.
And it's not even close anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like I read, what was it that, The Last of Us moved 4 million copies in its first weekend. Like if that was a film, it would make $1 billion in a single fucking weekend.
Yeah. It's, I mean, insane. Half of this is probably on Rockstar's back, like GTA and Red Dead sells so many freaking copies that.
Sure.
And Call of Duty, like.
Yeah, and like the EA games, like there's some, but like there's just like, you know, like The Last of Us 2 doesn't have nearly the cultural significance that like The Avengers does. But when you're talking about the number of people playing it and how much money it's making, it's night and day.
Yeah,
it's insane how much money's going in that. So it's cool to see these crossovers, and not in kind of like, you know, because I think other movies have tried to capitalize on that, like the movie Doom. You know, had that infamous kind of like 4-minute first person sequence. It kind of sort of works.
Uh-huh.
But this is just more of like, you know, in the middle of the fight scene, you'll just see a hit combo racking up. And when you KO people, and it does the classic like Street Fighter KO. And
And it just kind of expects that you get it, you know? And it's built around that. It's not like something that they said, oh, well, you know, this is a game movie, so shit, we got to do something game like. I don't know. Let's strap a camera to somebody's head and do that.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is built from the ground up with gamers in mind, and I liked it.
It's just woven in organically, like you said. Even the P-bar, like there's so many things that are just like that. And also this, they use like in a very comic book way. Like when you go into Scott's apartment and you see that like. Kieran Culkin, I can't remember his name, his character's name, but he literally owns everything except for one shitty poster and Scott's actual coat. And then there's this, I forget this, someone used this word on Brandon Routh, where he's like, do you even know what that word means? He's like, yeah. And then like this, something popped out of his head says he doesn't. Or like there's other things like where, you know, Ramona throughout the whole film is constantly correcting. Scott's like, you're 7 evil ex-boyfriends. She's like, 7 evil exes.
Mm-hmm.
And then like when he finally makes the realization that, you know, his girlfriend had a lesbian lover, it goes into his brain and there's this tile that goes, doesn't get it to gets it. And it just goes bing all the way over.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Like I can see like my dad watching that, because you don't need to understand all these video game mechanics to they enhance your appreciation. I can see them being annoying if you don't get it, but as a gamer and someone that likes that kind of frenetic, editing style, because I love like shit cranked movies, man.
Uh-huh.
Like the average cut scene is 0.25 seconds. The average length of a cut, like that stuff that's just like fucking moving, crazy shit happening all the time. I love that stuff. And Scott Pilgrim is probably the most accessible version of that.
Yeah.
And still to this day, I can't think of a movie that does it better.
and then certainly less offensive than Crank.
Much less offensive than Crank. Holy shit. So that'll do it for our coverage of the 10th anniversary of Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Next time on Bald Move Pulp Movies, we're going to be talking about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Do you know why? Because Bill and Ted are facing the music in late August, early September, and we want to get the cobwebs blown out of our brains on the Bill and Ted wavelength. So I'm looking forward to that. Hope you guys are too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.